Heather, this is Arnold from KOWS in Occidental, California.
Good, thanks. How are you?
Well, okay, thank you. It's a little chilly here today.
You're getting a lot of sympathy from me for that.
I imagine not. But, well, thank you so much for the interview and interesting subject. The new Iran-USA treaty, or the one that, well, went out beyond there to the P5, what interests me is that it was a single, well, the USA really negotiated it, then everyone came in after. Was that what happened?
No, I actually think you're being a bit unfair.
Okay.
A lot of the preparatory work was actually done by Catherine Ashton from the EU, and in some ways, this treaty really is really is as much a vindication for her as for anyone else, because she has been somewhat a mocked and disparaged figure in European foreign affairs, but for a considerable period of time, in part to give the U.S. some deniability, she actually took the lead in managing the preparatory process. And the U.S., as it turned out, at the same time, was conducting parallel negotiations through a back channel. But what I think it's important for people to understand is that this whole process only works because the Iranians know the U.S. isn't on its own, because Iran sells enough oil to China and has a strong enough relationship with Russia and certainly a completely separate relationship with the EU, that if all of those parties are not united, then Iran doesn't need to make a deal. So this only works if everyone is working together. So, you know, in that sense, the bilateral track that opened between the U.S. and Iran was important, but being able to have everybody around the table, you wouldn't have a deal without that.
Right, right. And do they really get around the table, or do, say, you know, does John Kerry actually sit face to face and really bash the table, or do they really, the main stuff is done through their representatives? How is that carried out in those type of negotiations?
You had some of both. You had a lot of work done at what's called the technical level, which is actually pretty senior people, and the sort of framework of a document pulled together. And then you have certain issues or certain turns of phrase that either lower-level officials don't have flexibility on, or ministers only want to give up to another minister. So there does come a point where Zarif, the Iranian negotiator, has to see John Kerry, and the words have to come from John Kerry's mouth: we will do X, or we will not do X. So this negotiation had formal preparatory talks, small talks in the hall, talks at ministerial level, talks over the phone at the presidential level. It had just about every trick in the negotiating playbook.
Well, it's interesting that they kept it quiet, though. That was the amazing thing.
Well, it is interesting because you had, 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, in the previous round, the one sort of eruption where a lot of news got out and there were all these stories subsequently denied by all the parties that France had changed the terms of the agreement at the last minute and that had prevented a deal from the last time around. But I do think, particularly in the aftermath of that, all sides decided that it was in nobody's interest for any details to get out. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons for that I think is important to underline is that every government involved in this process, particularly the democratic ones, but not only the democratic ones, face major debates at home and divided publics and divided elites about whether this deal is a good idea or not. So, you know, it's in every government's interest to have the simplest united front possible to sell the agreement.
You have the experience. You've been amongst power in the Clinton administration. Can you tell us about your background and what it was like walking those halls?
Sure. Well, I actually started out working at the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, what used to be known as the Helsinki Process, where I did my share of negotiating. So I have that experience as well of being the person in the room. And frankly, sometimes of being in the person in the room whose job it is to hold out and say, no, 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 until your boss gets there to say yes. So, you know, as a staff person, you understand what your role is in life, and your job is to say no until Washington is ready to say yes. And then after that, I spent a considerable amount of time as a speechwriter for Warren Christopher, Madeleine Albright, and then Bill Clinton. So, and in those environments, you really see, and this is true of the U.S., it's true for the EU, and in a different way, it's true for Iran, how much negotiation there is within a government before you even get to the international negotiating table. So the State Department wants one thing, the Pentagon wants something else. You have to keep in mind that Congress will only go for yet a third thing. So this process has layers upon layers, all of which are more complicated and, frankly, much less glamorous than I think people assume that it is. And yet, despite all of that, it still does sometimes come down to personalities. Mm. And you can have a conversation between, I'm not a big follower of the great man theory of history. I think institutions and outside factors play a much bigger role, but sometimes you have a person in a room who says something a particular way or makes a particular choice that a different senior official wouldn't have made. And I do think that this group of Iranians and John Kerry and Catherine Ashton, all for their own reasons, were particularly eager to get to an agreement at this moment in time.
Yeah, interesting, because that whole throwaway phrase that John Kerry said, wasn't it, at a press conference about, wasn't it that really that started a whole process, didn't it?
You know, I'm still not sure I believe that was a completely throwaway line, but I do think, John Kerry is somebody who has been preparing for this role most of his adult life, really. You know, he was involved in foreign affairs his whole time in Congress. This is obviously a job he's wanted very, very, very much. And so, you know, unlike maybe other secretaries of state we've had from both parties in recent memory who hadn't spent their lives steeped in the details of spending time in other people's countries and talking to their leaders, John Kerry really has. Mm. And I think he he's a man, this is likely the valedictory job of his career. So both personally and professionally, I do think he brings to it a level of understanding and an urgency that's maybe a little bit different from several of his immediate predecessors.
Yeah, interesting. And obviously, there was the political change in Iran. Ahmadinejad obviously was not too popular, let's say, and the new man seems to be striking a different stance. Negotiations were going on with Ahmadinejad, weren't they? Or did it not cross that line?
Well, you know, the great irony about Ahmadinejad is that he, for all of his crazy, offensive, hateful rhetoric, he actually would quite have liked to be the person who did a deal and brought it home. And in fact, because he became so unpopular domestically and he engaged in so much fighting with other factions in Iranian politics, he lost the trust of the supreme leader. And so he wasn't really... You may remember there were negotiations shortly after his dubious re-election in 2009, and his negotiator brought home an agreement which was repudiated by the Iranian government. So, in fact, Ahmadinejad did try, and both he was regarded skeptically by Western powers, and he was regarded skeptically by his own government and his own people. So, whereas... What's been fascinating about Rouhani, the new guy, is Iran doesn't have democratic elections in the way that we recognize them. They have selections. The supreme leader chooses who is allowed to run. of the candidates who were chosen, Rouhani was viewed as the most reformist, one much bigger than, frankly, people expect him to, and immediately made a huge effort to signal both to Iranians and to the rest of the world that he wanted to change the tone, to get away from the Ahmadinejad tone, and also to make some substantive deals. So one has to be careful because Iran is still fundamentally a non-democratic regime with power controlled in the hands of a very small number of people who aren't democratically elected. But the relationship of both who the president is and the perception of the supreme leader that there needed to be a president who had some more legitimacy with the citizens does represent a real change.
Right. Now, obviously, other things changed. The foreign minister, how has he been in this? Javad Zarif, has he been very accommodating?
Well, this is also a completely fascinating thing. Zarif is Western-educated, I'm trying to remember where, fluent in English. For your curious listeners, although Twitter is officially banned in Iran, both Rouhani and Zarif have their own English-language Twitter accounts, which are very sophisticated. I mean, whoever writes their Twitter account has a fluidity with the English language that I'm a bit jealous of. And they have worked incredibly hard to use channels of, you know, not just media channels, but new media channels. They put out a YouTube video, for heaven's sake. So there's a real, you know, sort of Iran jumped from the 1970s to the 21st century in one go. And Zarif, you know, he knows the players. He knows, in many cases, he knows people personally. He's had, you know, long-standing relationships with them. And while, again, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't change the nature of the Iranian regime, it doesn't change that both sides distrust each other, and rightly so, but it does introduce a little bit less, maybe, personal miscommunication than was the case in the past.
Do you think this will be looked at as a blockbuster deal, like the Helsinki Accords or Camp David, or is it just more of a smaller intermediary thing in terms of history?
It has the potential to be the first step that opens up to something really big. It has the potential to be a nothing that fell apart in 6 months and that everyone is kind of embarrassed about. Or it has the potential to stand on its own. And I think, you know, so Camp David, if you think about Camp David, Camp David was huge in and of itself. And at the time, there was the hope and expectation that it would only be the first of a number of similar such things.
Right.
And so, you know, Camp David stands as a monumental agreement, but frankly, it's not as monumental as its architects hoped that it would be. Mm. And so in some ways, you know, if you imagine an outcome where Iran's program stays frozen as it is, and there are inspections, and there's never a further agreement, so we end up with sort of a status quo minus, you know, then do we see it as like Camp David, or do we see it as like Oslo, an agreement that had enormous promise, didn't lead anywhere? I mean, the Helsinki analogy is interesting, of course, because most people thought that was a complete waste of time for a decade or two, and then suddenly in 1989 it came to look like a fabulous masterstroke. Okay. So, which is all a good lesson about not judging these things
right.
too quickly.
Exactly. We want answers immediately. Yeah. Or we want history immediately, I should say. There's naysayers in this, obviously within the country. Obviously, the Republican Party came out against it strongly, as one would expect. And of course, Israel. Do you see any linkages there, or is it just crocodile tears for Netanyahu?
No, I think, you know, it's important to acknowledge that Israelis, and not just Netanyahu, but broadly in the society, see Iran as an existential threat. Mm. And if you see something as an existential threat to your society, then you're going to regard any claim by other powers to whom it's not an existential threat in the same way, with a certain amount of skepticism. And so I think, you know, it's very important when you talk about this to start from the premise that, you know, the Israeli view of the world really does cause them to take a very serious and dubious eye toward Iran, and that is bigger than Mr. Netanyahu and some of his outbursts, maybe. Mm-hmm. Then I do think you can divide both in Israel and in the U.S. opposition into a couple of camps. And one camp says, we want a negotiated agreement, and we think we could have gotten a better one. And these are the folks who say, oh, you know, we need bad cops. And then you do have another group of people who just don't believe any agreement is possible and think we should move as quickly as possible to a military approach. And what it's important to point out about that second group is that it actually doesn't include anyone in the U.S. military. That if you talk to both current and former senior military officials, they are on the record as being very strongly supportive of the negotiated agreement, not believing that the U.S. can permanently stop the Iranian program with a military strike, and believing that the negative consequences of attacking Iran would be very, very, very great. So there is a certain amount of opposition that frankly is not based in, does not accord with what the military strategic analysis of the facts on the ground is. And then there's another faction that just says, yeah, we could have negotiated this better. And you know what? You want to negotiate better, you got to win elections and be the ones in charge of negotiating.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, I mean, the American situation, obviously, when we go back in history, I like history, and I suppose, like many things America does, like bin Laden, we sometimes start things, the unforeseen consequences. And I think America helped the Shah originally, didn't it, with its nuclear program, and
yes,
and Israel as well. So I'm wondering if there's still connections at those levels, I know between the Israeli and Iran, because they were very friendly before the overthrow.
Well, there's an enormous Iranian diaspora in Israel, actually, and there's been some efforts at the citizen level to rebuild contact between Iranian Jewish citizens of Israel and Iranian citizens of Iran. There are lots of ties that other, you wouldn't think it, but there's a rather surprisingly large architecture of quasi-governmental Iranian officials and academics who, anytime there's a thaw, have been engaging in, what we call track two diplomacy or unofficial diplomacy. So, although it dwindled very badly during the Ahmadinejad period, but there are these contacts. There are also, the European countries that still have embassies in Iran that have served as intermediaries. So, there have been, and interestingly, again, another place where you get this is the U.S. military saying, we'd actually like to have more communications with Iran, the Iranian military, than we do, in order to reduce the risk of unintentional conflict in the Gulf. So there are channels that exist, and there is the desire for more channels.
Talk about the actual agreement itself. Can you give us a quick rundown of what it really means and what they specifically have proposed?
Right. So what the agreement says is that the Iranians will stop enriching uranium to the 20% level, which is the level at which you start to get to where you can quickly make it useful to make weapons. But they will convert some of what they have at 20% down to a lower level, which is only suitable for medical or power-generating use. And so that already means that the agreement, if implemented, will actually move them further away from being able to make a nuclear weapon. It would introduce inspectors at three of their main nuclear sites, and it actually foresees that the inspectors would be in those sites daily, which would make it the most intrusive inspection regime ever negotiated. In return for that, out of the something like $100 billion of sanctions that the international community has on the Iranians, about $7 billion would get freed up. And so that's basically giving the Iranians back $7 billion of their own money while leaving the structure of the sanctions intact so they could be reinstated if necessary. Now, what isn't done yet is the sort of follow-on agreement which negotiates how each side does what together. And those technical talks, I think, start next week. And the idea is that as soon as those talks are done and both sides start implementing, the six-month clock starts ticking, the idea being this agreement is good for 6 months, during which time a final disposition of Iran's nuclear program is meant to be negotiated.
Oh, okay. So really we're just in a paperwork build-up to that clock ticking then for the six
yes.
months. Okay. And then during that 6 months, the actual, they'll go one step further or how will, what are they looking at in terms of additional items?
Right. Well, what the position that's laid out in UN Security Council resolutions is that we would get back to a place where Iran is not enriching any nuclear material. Many believe that Iran will not give up enrichment altogether, and indeed Iran has said it won't, but that the final agreement will be that Iran gets back to where it is only enriching at the 3.5, that is the medical or power generating level, and there is sufficient intrusive and permanent inspections to give Iran's neighbors and countries like the U.S. a high level of confidence that it's not secretly enriching enough that it could pop up one day and say, hey, we have a bomb, or we're going to have a bomb in 3 months or 6 months or 2 years. And then in exchange for that, many more of the sanctions regimes would come off, giving Iran the ability to use the international banking system to receive hard currency payments for its oil, to get technology and investment to actually modernize its oil fields. So those are the big desiderata on both sides.
Obviously, with all the leaks and things that have been going on and all the NSA stuff, it seems, I suppose, pretty obvious. And what's happened in terms of some of the viruses that have attacked the Iranian nuclear program, I suppose, yeah, can something derail this during this, as they're doing the paperwork, could say an item suddenly come up that, you know, they just can't get over and the clock never starts ticking?
Yes, I think that's a very real possibility. Actually, one thing that could derail it is that the agreement says that no new sanctions will be imposed during the six-month period, and there are some in the U.S. Congress who feel very strongly that more sanctions should be imposed. So if that were to happen, it is possible that Iran would use that as a reason to walk away from the deal. Similarly, Iran, in addition to its nuclear program, which is under negotiation, is known to be a primary sponsor of Hezbollah and other extremist terrorist groups. And if there were to be an attack on Western interests or Israeli interests, that might well derail the talks as well. There's always concern about military interactions between Iranian and U.S. naval vessels in the Persian Gulf, and you could imagine. And you know, the point here is some of these things could happen by accident. Some of them could happen by miscalculation, i.e. people in Congress thinking that it would strengthen the president's hand to have more sanctions, when in fact it might derail the process. Or, you know, you have hardliners in Iran who may very well not want the negotiations to succeed. And so one of the worrying things is that you could imagine someone staging an attack of some kind in order to provoke the Western powers into walking away from the agreement. So I think all those things are possible. And then, you know, as you allude, in addition to all of that, there are covert programs run by the Israelis, run by the U.S., perhaps run by others, and those things, you know, they have a life of their own.
Well, yeah, that's what I've always felt about this situation, that I'm sure, as you say, it's very salient to their being, the Israelis, this situation. And if they don't know what's going on more than any, that I'm sure they know better than the Iranians as to what their nuclear program is. And I think that's why they haven't bombed it like the Iraqi reactor is my opinion anyway.
Well, the additional piece of that is that the Iranians understand very well the Israelis' intentions and capabilities, and they have worked very hard to make their facilities such that Israel's military capabilities can't destroy them. Mm. And the Israelis know that they could inflict real damage but not end the program, and that's one of the reasons that they have held off, because they believe that the only military shot at really doing major, major damage to the program is a joint U.S.-Israeli strike. So the Israelis understand that a unilateral Israeli strike is something to hold back for a moment of great, great desperation.
You talked about it briefly, Hezbollah and Syria, that connection with Iran and obviously with Iraq there in the equation. What's happening in that balance of power there?
Yeah, so here we're also in a really interesting and unnerving pivot moment, because Iran is, one of Assad's two last big allies in Syria with the Russians, and Hezbollah, which for some period actually kind of tried to stay out of the conflict in Syria and focus on its aims in Lebanon and elsewhere, has now been thoroughly pulled into it and is completely identified with Assad and his government. The Iranians in some ways are sort of all in Syria. At the same time as there's tremendous strife and violence in Iraq, where Iran is also all in on this, on one side. Right. Now, having said all of that, the Iranian public has shown some restiveness. Why, with our own economy in such dire straits and us under all these sanctions, why are we sending stuff to Syria? And they've seen the horrible videos on YouTube and the reporting, and there has been some significant civilian unrest. Why are we supporting this guy who is killing his citizens? And the chemical weapons was a very interesting moment, because chemical weapons were used in the war between Iraq and Iran, and Iranians suffered terribly. And so Iranians looked at these videos and said, wait, why are we supporting the people who use chemical weapons? So actually the government is under pressure there as well, and actually would like to have an outcome where it was a little less costly for it to prop up the Assad regime, which may provide an opening, although it's hard to be optimistic about that outcome.
Yes, really. There's too many wounds on that body now, it seems. I suppose, I hate intervention in any way, but in Syria it seems it should have been sooner rather than later or never, as has happened.
Well, the challenge has been finding an intervention that would leave things better off than they were before. And realistically, because you have the Russians and the Iranians so committed to having a regime that considers their interests, ultimately, you're not going to have a stable solution until you get them both bought in, and you now have the presence of Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups such as Al-Nusra, which cares about nobody and is controllable by nobody. So the fact is, you say that it's been let go so long, to reach a solution, you're going to have to negotiate very hard with the Russians and Iranians, which is going to produce an outcome that's maybe somewhat unpalatable, and you're still going to face the security solution of dealing with Al-Nusra and other groups, which just aren't going to they're not there to negotiate. There's not something you can give them short of turning Syria into a theocratic Sharia state,
right,
that they want. The point in this is that Iran is the good news story, and that actually making progress there and showing, frankly, all sides that there are benefits and hard, suspicious negotiating can produce good outcomes for all sides is probably the only way you're going to get any momentum forward on some of these other intractable issues.
Well, that's a very good point, isn't it? It's got to start somewhere. And the nuclear thing is a focal point, and if some if some agreement can come from that, yeah, there is room for more then, I would say, yeah. As, 40 years later after the overthrow, it's about time.
Right, well, to get back to your Helsinki Final Act, peace analogy, sometimes these things take a terribly long time to bear fruit, and the human costs in the Syria case are really unacceptably high. I mean, this is, it's not a situation that any civilized person should feel pleased about, that we as the international community can't figure out a way to prevent a government from willfully throwing its own society into this kind of violent chaos.
Well, thank you so much, Heather. Fascinating subject, and you really opened it up a lot. Thank you very much. We hope that it goes the right way.
My pleasure, and I will hope the same, and that perhaps we'll talk again and there'll be good news to report.
I would love to do that. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Have a good evening.
Thank you, Heather.